The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Sports Talk New York on WGBB here in Merrick, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here with you on this. It's the 20th day of July, 2025. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is with us as always. And I'm glad to have you aboard tonight. We've got a big show for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome back the 1969 Miracle Met, Art Shamsky. He'll join us up next after Art. We start a cavalcade of great authors on the show. Chris Donnelly will speak to us about his new book, On the Road to the 2000 Subway Series. In the three spot, we'll welcome in Steve Ditmore. He's written a new book about what we call the forgotten Dodger, Jim Gilliam. And last but not least, we talk about the Dodgers 85 World Series, as documented so well in this great book from Marshall Garvey. So we got a packed show for you tonight, so settle in, sit back, relax, enjoy the chat tonight. Got some great stuff up ahead for you. Before we start, as always, I invite you to follow me on my Facebook page. It's called The Talk of New York Sports, sports information, show information, some great photos. Stop by, give it a look. You can also follow me on X at BDonahueWGBB, all one word. And if you miss a show, don't worry, because they're all out on the website at www.sportstalknewyork.com. Catch up anytime at your leisure. Our first guest, he was an integral player on the 1969 World Series champion Miracle Mets. He batted 300 with 14 home runs while platooning in right field, and then he hit just 538 in the postseason. He's got several great things we want to get to tonight that I know you'll be interested in. His book, upcoming appearances. So I will welcome back to Sports Talk New York tonight, Art Shamsky. Art, good evening.
Bill, it's always great to be with you. Hope all is well with you.
Very, very good, Art. Yeah, things are okay. Now, Art will be taking part in the upcoming Legends of Baseball cruise. And, Art, we have a special guest to tell us more about this. Please introduce this gentleman, Art.
Yeah, Dave DeMeo, who puts together these baseball cruises, is going to be a wonderful time in May of 2026. It'll be similar to the Yankees versus the Mets. There'll be some terrific Yankee players along with some former Met greats, including Doc Gooden and Howard Johnson and myself, and there'll be some wonderful Yankee players, and Dave can tell you about, but it's going to be a great time, and I just want to introduce Dave to the fans out there and yourself. And Dave, welcome to the show, and go ahead and talk about the cruise in May of 2026.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak less about our cruise coming up in May 17th, 2026. Legends of Baseball Cruise. It's a wonderful event. It's on the Celebrity Apex, leaving out of Port Liberty in New Jersey. It's a week-long cruise. We spend 3 days docked in Bermuda. And to give you a little bit about it, I organize all the events on the cruise with all the players. So to give you a little bit of a lineup, obviously we have Art, Doc Gooden, and Howard Johnson. We have Charlie Hayes. We have Mickey Rivers, Ron Bloomberg, Chuck Knoblauch, Jesse Barfield, and Homer Bush. I think that rounds out everybody. And it's a wonderful time. It's a different aspect to meet the players. If you're a rabid fan for the Mets or the Yankees, it's a wonderful time. It's not going to like a show or a signing where you get a few minutes. I mean, you're with them for the week. We do an opening cocktail hour. We meet everybody, you get to talk to them. We do a Q&A session. We do a game show. We actually rented a private resort where we have a wonderful wiffle ball game against the pros. They pitch. It's an incredible event. We have a few other things that we do there. We also have a closing night. We play a video. It's just a great way to kind of meet your heroes and talk to players and hear the stories. You know, I make the statement that it's, you always know where Ron Hoenberg and Mickey Rivers are because they're usually sitting up in the dining room with 20 or 30 people around telling stories. So it's just a wonderful event. It's very, very social. All the players engage, and they just have a wonderful time.
Now, I don't know if you mentioned it, Dave. Where is the cruise going to?
Oh, we're going to, Alvich, we're going to Bermuda. I apologize.
Nice. Okay, great.
Port Liberty to Bermuda. So it's 2 days at sea, 3 days docked in Bermuda, and then 2 days back. So it goes from a, it's a Saturday.
Nice. And anything else you want to tell the folks about this, Dave?
You should check it out. I mean, it's Legends of Baseball Cruise. You can get information at info@artshansky.com. If you do happen to look us up online, please put that you heard it here first on the radio station with Bill and Art so that we're aware if there are any questions or, you know, any other information you need, travel schedule, you know, feel free to reach out. Again, it's legendsofbaseballcruise.com or info@artshansky.com. And please, in the memo, please put that you heard it from us on the radio station with Bill and Art.
Wonderful. Dave, I thank you for being with us. Thanks for your time. Again, folks, that's legendsofbaseballcruise.com is the website. You can also go to artshansky.com. All the information you need. If you have any questions, you could reach out to Dave, and he will kindly get back to you. So if that's not it, Dave, we'll thank you for your time, and we'll carry on with Art.
We appreciate it, Art. As always, it's always a pleasure, and it was a great time. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Dave. Well, Art Shamsie's with us, folks. For those who don't know, Art has recently penned a great book titled Mets Stories I Only Tell My Friends, written with Matthew Silverman. It's getting a lot of attention. A friend who used to write for Newsday of mine currently reading the book. And Matthew recently participated in the Baseball Hall of Fame's author series up in Cooperstown with the book. What gave you the idea for this great book, Art?
Well, you know, Bill, I've written three books in generally about the New York Mets, the 69 Mets in particular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's probably more books have been written about that team than any sports team in history. Maybe more books have been written about the Yankees organization, but certainly an individual team. I don't think any more books have been written about a team than the 69 Mets. And while I was trying to figure out what I wanted to write about, someone told me about a book that former President Dwight Eisenhower wrote many years ago called At Ease, Stories I Tell My Friends. And I looked it up and looked at some of the pages, and it made me think about all the stories that haven't been told about the 69 Mets. And so what I did is I just talked about some things that I experienced on and off the field. There's nothing in this book that's going to make anybody feel like they're going to find some bad stuff about any players. That's not going to happen. It's really a fun kind of look at things that I did on and off the field. And again, stretching out some of the stories and adding some of the stories that have already been told. There's so much going on about that team, even now, 56 years later. So for me, it was just a labor of love to write about that team again and about my experiences, including when I found out I was traded to the Mets. That in itself is a story that people didn't know about, and my shock at first being traded and second finding out was to the team that was losing 100 games a year. And I think people will get a kick out of finding out my reaction and when I found out coming from the Reds over to the Mets. And then it was just really about some of the experiences, like I said, that I had with my roommates and my teammates and things with the Mets and a couple things about the Cincinnati Reds, but really about the 69 Mets.
Excellent. And some of the names that the fans will see in the book, Art, give us an example of some of the players that you mentioned.
Well, you know, initially I talk about, again, when I was over with the Reds and got traded over to the Mets, I came up with the Reds, and of course we never won a pennant or a World Series when I was with them, but we had great teams. Frank Robinson was there, Pete Rose, Tony Perez, Johnny Bench. I mean,
all these great names. And so for me, spending 8 years in that organization in the minor leagues and the big leagues and finding out I was traded was really a shock. But then when I got over to the Mets, my relationships with some of the players of that I became so close to, like Eddie Crane Poole and Kenny Boswell, my roommate, and Cleon Jones and Tommy Agee and Ron Swoboda. I mean, the names go on and on. When you go from a team that finishes ninth, a half game out of last place, which we did in 1968, and then win a World Series, it changes your life. And I talk about how that team is still 56 years later is talked about and relished in people's mind because of what we did and what we accomplished, where we came from. So many factors are into why that team is so popular, including how we even beat a team that won 107, 108 games in the regular season in the World Series in the Baltimore Orioles. But really, the team was known as the lovable losers in those early years. And then to turn it around and win it at a time when the city and the country was really involved in a war, the war in Vietnam, and really a turbulent time. You know, we're in a world that's upside down now, Bill, and even now we have a lot of problems. Back in the late 60s, that war in Vietnam was tearing the country apart, and the city was going under in so many ways, financially, socially, morally, spiritually. And we and the Jets and the Knicks, who all won in that period of time, all for the first time, ironically, that was my first book, The Magnificent Seasons, and we all won for the first time. And I think people pass that on, that legacy, what we did to make them feel better about their lives, and I pass it on from generation to generation. You know, I meet young people today who weren't even born who know about that team from their parents and their grandparents. And for me to be able to talk to people, I find, you know, when I meet people who were around at that time and talk about that team, it kind of brings back their youth a little bit. It makes me feel younger just to talk about it. I see their eyes light up, and they remember when their parents took them to games, and then when they took their children to games, and maybe they took their grandchildren to the games back then. And it really is kind of a period in all of our lives that are so special. And again, even though it's been 56 years, it's still a big part of my life and a big part of a lot of people's life because it brings back so many wonderful memories.
What a great connection to make with people through the ball club, Art. That's for sure. Now, we're talking to Art Shamsky tonight about his book, Met Stories I Only Tell My Friends. Now, Art, where can fans get the book or any of your other books?
Well, they can get them on Amazon for sure in bookstores. But if they want a personalized copy, they can go to my website, info@artshamsky.com or artshamsky.com. They'll get an autographed copy from me. But it's still doing really well in the bookstores and then, like I said, on Amazon. And I think they'll really enjoy it. It's a little bit of a different take on my career and my life. And there's some fun stories and a couple serious stories. And a very special time in my life. You know, Bill, I played 13 years, and really, for all intents and purposes, nobody ever talks about the other 12. Yeah. It's always about 1969, and I go out to these personal appearances and do these things, and people tell me everything that they remember about that period of life. And what's really funny is I probably over the years have met 100,000 people who told me that they were at the last game, October 16th, 1969, when we won the World Series. And
right.
I said, that's great. And I realized the ballpark held about 51,000 to 52,000 people. So either they were there or they weren't there. But in their minds, if they think they were there, that's fine with me. And, unfortunately, we've lost so many wonderful guys from that team, including five last year. And recently, Ron Taylor, a terrific pitcher for the Mets that year, and he just passed away. So we've lost a lot of key members. But I've got so many wonderful memories sharing on and off the field with those guys, and I miss the camaraderie and the fun times, but the reality of it is I have these great memories, and I get a chance to talk to wonderful people like yourself who still remember that team and want to talk about it. Incidentally, before I forget, I don't know if you remember this, though, Bill, that today's date was a very big day in 1969 history. It was the walk on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in Montreal. Our plane had problems getting out of Montreal. We had to wait around at the airport. We all watched that walk on the moon, and it happened with the 56, whatever years it is, on this day back in 1969.
Right. A historic day. another historic day in 1969. Art, I was checking out the website earlier, artchamsky.com, and folks, you can get a lot more than the signed books. The signed books are available there, but the holidays are coming up, and there's some great gift ideas for your baseball fan there. There's a lithograph with Art Chamsky and the Bulldog from Everybody Loves Raymond, a great signed lithograph. And then what I saw that was amazing was there's a signed original Israel League baseball. And maybe some of the folks don't realize that you managed in Israel, Art.
Yeah, I did 2007, Bill. It was an inaugural season for baseball, the Israel Baseball League. It unfortunately only lasted 1 year. It was not put together with really well, and ran out of funds, mismanagement. But the reality of it is it was the beginning of baseball becoming interesting to fans and people back in that country. There was really not many really good fields. It was prehistoric, for lack of a better word. It was not great baseball, but I really enjoyed my time there. I met a lot of people, learned a lot about the state of Israel and surrounding areas, and it was very educational for me. And I believe those of us who were part of that league, and again, even though it lasted 1 year, it was very significant, but I do believe it was the beginning of Israel taking notice and wanting to develop the game of baseball, and that since then they built some fields, they built some stadiums, and they've done really well in the World Baseball Classic and the Olympics. And so I think all of us who were there initially really were catalysts in them deciding that they wanted to develop the game. And to their credit, they've got some good players now in the big leagues, a number of players who either were born there or played in subsequent leagues. So I think they're really developing the game there, and they want to be a factor in international baseball, and I think they're becoming that.
We're speaking with Art Chamsky tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, if you'd like to meet Art, you have a great opportunity to do so. It's coming up this Tuesday, July 22nd, and it's at the Great Donovan's in Woodside. Tell the folks a little bit about that, Art.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Donovan's is a great place, and it really is a nice place to meet and be around people. And Bill, Donahue and Donovan, that's a little close connection there. I'm hoping you might stop in and have a little pop with me, maybe a little beer or something.
Have a pint, sure, yeah. That's folks, you go
ahead. I'm looking forward to it because it's a big Met territory, a lot of Met fans, and I really enjoy talking to people and reminiscing with people about 1969, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Let me. Do you know the address, right, Bill? Let me give you the address just in case people might.
Sure. Go ahead, Art. Yeah.
57-24 Roosevelt Avenue in Woodside, Queens. And so it's a big Met hangout, and that's not to say that if you follow other teams, you can't come in and have a drink and say hello. But I know a lot of Met fans will be there. I'm really looking forward to it.
It's great, folks. You get off the 7 train or the Long Island Railroad in Woodside, head down to the street. Donovan's is right there. Get yourself a French onion soup or one of the best burgers in Manhattan or in New York City.
Sounds like you've been there before, Bill.
Oh, yeah. I must confess, all right. Yeah, I've had a pint or two there. Now, will you have your books with you?
I will. I'm going to have some books and some photos and some of the memorabilia you mentioned before. I find people are really interested in some of the old pictures I have that show myself with a couple of teammates. And again, you mentioned the one with Everybody Loves Raymond and the dog. And you know, a lot of people talking to me about when I appeared on that program way back in 1999. And I still have people coming up to me and say, you know, they named the dog after you, Everybody Loves Raymond. And I tell them, yeah, we did it, 26 years ago. I get a kick out of it because it was such a great experience for me. But, you know, the reality of it, Bill, is all these things I've done over the years wouldn't have happened if I wasn't part of that 69 Met team. Being on the Ed Sullivan Show, singing out in Vegas for 17 days after we won the World Series, the Dick Cavett Show, doing Sesame Street with Eddie Cranepool.
Right.
I mean, the list goes on and on. Really because I was part of that team that is so special and, again, lives on forever. For me, it really
is a big part of my life. And, you know, one of the things I get, Bill, and I think you can appreciate it, is that I get people always saying to me, don't you wish you were playing now and making the money they're making now? And my first reaction is, of course you don't, everybody wants to be making all that money. But,
sure.
You know, I think about it, and the reality of it is I wouldn't trade for that World Series ring. I've got one of just a few people that has that wonderful World Series ring from 1969. But just as important is I played with and against, I think, the greatest conglomerate of players in the history of the game. In the 60s and early 70s, from Willie Mays to Hank Aaron to Roberto Clemente to Willie Stargell to Bukovy to Bench, Robinson, Rose, Perez. I mean, the list goes on, and all the great pitchers, Koufax, Drysdale, Marischal, Gibson, Carlton, Seaver, Jim Bunning, I can go on and on. This is just the National League. So for me to be able to talk about that time with all those great players and sharing those moments is always going to be special. And so that's how I rationalize in my mind that, yeah, I would love to be playing now. It's unbelievable to be a big league player at this point, making all the money they're making. But I wouldn't trade it for the life I've got, so I've got no complaints.
No, it certainly was a golden age, the 60s and 70s, Art. You're definitely right there. So that's Tuesday the 20th, folks, at Donovan's down there in Woodside. Also, the Mets are playing the Angels that night at Citi Field, so it's perfect to stop by for a pregame meal. What else you got coming up, Art?
Well, I got, you know, I'm just always doing some personal appearances, Bill, but and signings and the usual stuff that it never gets old. I just, it's really for me always something comes up at the last minute, but I've got things going on that, but I'm looking forward to Tuesday. That's the big thing coming up.
That'll be great. Yeah. Now people are always asking, Art, how are the Miracle Mets doing these days? Have you spoken to any of the guys lately and how are they doing?
Well, I follow the team. You know, they've got a pretty good team. I think pitching is really going to be the key to the second half of the season. And of course, defense is always important. But the way the game is now, Bill, it's a little different than when I played. You had to win a division and then win a pennant and then get into World Series. But now, the thing about it is just make the playoffs. There's so many teams make the playoffs, and I think you kind of build yourself up to get hot during the second half of the season at some point. And if you can get into the playoffs, and there's no reason why the Mets can't make it in the playoffs, and then all of a sudden get hot, get some pitching, get some defense, timely hitting, anything can happen. But they certainly have a decent team and a good team, well enough to get into the playoffs.
They sure do. Now, your teammates, the 69 Mets, any of those guys, how are they doing these days?
Well, you know, again, we lost five guys last year and one guy this year so far. And it's been tough for all of us who are still around to lose friends like that and teammates who are so special. You get older, Bill. It is what it is. You,
right.
Those phone calls, not always great phone calls, and you deal with it. But in my case, I'm still around and hopefully still going to be able to do things and share moments with fans out there. But the guys that are still around are doing okay. I talk to Jerry Kuzman all the time. Kenny Boswell's down in Austin, Texas, Ron Sabota, and I do some things together, and it's always great to see Ronnie and a couple of the other guys. Rod Gasper's still around, Duffy Dyer's still around, Jason Martin's still around. We've got about 13 or 14 guys still around, but we lost a lot of great teammates and all the coaches and, of course, our wonderful manager, Gil Hodges. But, you just keep plugging away, and you're thankful for those moments you shared together. It's funny, people always say to me, do you miss the game? And the reality of it is I do miss the game, but I miss the locker room. I miss the clubhouse. I miss those shared moments where you were shared these intimate times with guys on and off the field. Those 0-for-4s that were shared and those 2-for-4s were shared. And just those moments that you have on and off the field to me are always going to be special. And when we lose guys on teams that play for us, especially the 69 Mets, because they were so special, it's always a difficult time.
Right, but they live on, Art. They live on through guys like you who proliferate the memory of the team and those guys, and that's really appreciated by fans like me, and I'm sure the fans that you meet feel the same way. They're not really gone because their memory and their legends live on.
Well, you know, Bill, I always tell people there's two teams in the history of the game that resonate with fans years after they won, and one of them is going to be 100 years in 2 years, and that's the 27 Yankees with Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and that great cast of players they had. But the other's the 69 Mets. We're now 56 years later, and people still talk about that team, and I think it'll be one of these teams that for years from now, people will still talk about it. That legacy have been passed on from generation to generation, and it's what I mentioned before. It's because of where we came from being a bad team, what was going on in the world at the time, and what we accomplished. And then, of course, beating that terrific Baltimore Orioles team that had great players and losing that first game. And I incidentally made the last out of that first game, which I talk about occasionally because it's one at-bat I think about every day of my life. I came up in the ninth inning as a time run and grounded out the second base in the game. Everybody thought we were going to lose four in a row, and we ended up winning the next four. So I think all of those factors come into play as why that team so resonates with fans so many years later. And I think it will continue to resonate because that legend and those stories will be passed on from generation to generation.
That's right. And kids, just think about it. The United States and mankind in general walked on the moon today for the first time ever. And a couple of months later, the New York Mets are world champions. So, as Art and I said earlier, what else do you need in 1969? Maybe Woodstock? It was a tremendous year. And Art, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us here at Sports Talk New York. The best to you and Teresa. Again, the legendsofbaseballcruise.com, folks. Check that out. Art's Met Stories, I Only Tell My Friends, available on Amazon or on artshamsky.com, where there's some great items available. Donovan's in Woodside, Tuesday night, Art Shamsky. Before you head out to the Mets game, stop by, have a burger, shake hands with Art Shamsky, get one of his signed books. And Art, once again, thank you.
My pleasure, Bill. It's always great talking to you. Stay well.
That is the great Art Shamsky, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we'll talk to Chris Donnelly, another great author, about his book, On the Road to the 2000 Subway Series. So stick around, folks.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, we are back with Sports Talk New York on WGBB AM/FM radio, live from beautiful downtown Merrick, Long Island, New York. Well, it's the first week back from the All-Star break. It's really the first year I really watched almost all the events. No red carpet. You'll never get me to watch that. The softball game is embarrassing. They need to bring in the Savannah Bananas or somebody else to fill that slot. The celebrity softball, I know none of the celebrities. Maybe I'm out of touch, but I knew Jenny Finch and CeCe Sabathia. The rest have no idea. All the Mets got into the game. Of course, Pete with a three-run homer. At the end, the game was tied, so they have what's called the swing-off. Now, to me, that sounds like something extramarital. They should come up with another word for that. Of course, Schwarber got all the accolades for his three bombs in that. I'm kind of glad that Pete didn't have to hit, though. I didn't want him to possibly embarrass himself on a national stage. Putting Jacob Mizorowski on the team after five games, I thought that was ridiculous. And the huge spotlight put on Paul Skeens and Tarik Skubal, I thought that was kind of crazy as well. So at least we're back to what we think is normalcy, part two of the season, and on the road to the World Series, which brings us to our next guest. He's the author of two previous books that take a detailed look at New York City baseball in the late 20th century. Doc Donnie, the Kid, and Billy Brawl, How the 1985 Mets and Yankees Fought for New York's Baseball Soul. And the next book is titled Road to Nowhere, The Early 1990s Collapse and Rebuild of New York City Baseball. His latest book is called Get Your Tokens Ready, The Late 1990s Road to the Subway Series. I welcome to the show tonight Chris Donnelly. Chris, good evening.
Bill, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
Doing fine, Chris. Now, give us a little background on yourself, where you grew up, and what teams did you support when you were a kid?
Sure. So I grew up in North Jersey in a town called Pompton Lakes, about 25 miles outside of New York City. And I grew up, and I fully admit this, it's no secret, I grew up a Yankees fan in a family full of Mets fans.
Okay.
I guess that was my own little mini rebellion. But, yeah, I grew up a Yankees fan, started watching them when they were terrible.
Yeah, I remember those days. Well, yeah. As I mentioned in the introduction, your previous books, including this one, it's a trilogy, right?
Yeah, it didn't start out that way, but it ended up being a trilogy, and it covers New York City baseball from 1985 to 2000. And I just find that a fascinating time to look at and reexamine both teams.
Right. Now, you start by going back to really the first regular season meetings between the Yankees and the Mets. Let's talk about that. We have the famous Dave Malicki game.
Yeah, I knew when I was starting to write this book that I wanted to open with the Dave Malicki game because I think it highlights just how special the Subway Series was when it first started, that a guy like Dave Malicki, of all people in the world, is the first pitcher to pitch for the Mets in that game. And not only that, but he ends up having this sort of immortality because of the performance that he puts in, pitching a complete game shutout. And Dave Malicki still gets mail to this day from Mets fans asking him to sign things, sign newspaper headlines from the next day. And I just think that's really special and just shows you what it was that he still 30 years later almost gets remembered for that.
It's like a Jimmy Qualls moment, noted for one thing. And he will live on forever because of that one game. Now, 1996, the season ended with the Yankees winning the first World Series in 18 years. And they got their parade. And the Mets ended the season. They were really struggling to keep managers and quality players. And they had controversy brewing in the clubhouse and off the field.
Yeah, the 96 Mets, there were high expectations going in. They kind of surprised everybody by finishing in second place in 95. And so people were really excited for the 96 season, and it fell apart pretty quickly. They finished 71 and 91, and they fired their manager, Dallas Green, that August. It just wasn't working. Generation K, the three young pitchers who were supposed to, Wilson, Isringhausen, Pulsifer, they never panned out. So they get rid of Green, they bring in Bobby Valentine, and he spends the last few weeks of 96 basically reevaluating the team and deciding who needs to stay, who needs to go. They go a little bit more towards a youth movement while adding in some veterans here and there, and they surprise everybody in 97. They kind of come out of nowhere, and they have a tremendous amount of comeback wins. So not only are they winning, they're exciting. They finish 88 and 74. They make a playoff run right up until the last week of the season. And they sort of announced that they're going to be competing for the heart of New York City. The Yankees are winning championships, but we're back, and we're going to be there too.
Yeah, And they were for a while. Now, we're speaking with Chris Donnelly tonight. The book is Get Your Tokens Ready. And now we look at 2000, Chris, and the Yankees, a dynasty is brewing again. Undisputed kings of New York, three series titles in four seasons, and the Mets have rebuilt their team, we see, as you said, not only to be competitive, but they're building one dramatic moment after another.
Yeah, the Mets are, I kind of feel that the late 90s Mets are unfairly forgotten. I understand if you're a Mets fan not necessarily wanting to relive those years because of how they ended up losing to the Braves in the NLCS in 99, losing the Subway, spoiler alert, losing the Subway Series in 2000. But they were really exciting teams, and I think they deserve better than they've gotten over the years. I would argue that the 99 Mets are a top three, if not top five, Mets team of all time. And the last 3 weeks of that season, including the playoffs, are some of the most exciting moments in Mets history, right? Right up until, obviously, the heartbreak of the Kenny Rogers walk in the NLCS.
But oh boy, yeah.
to claw back and get into a playoff spot after they had almost blown a playoff spot, and then to beat the Diamondbacks, to walk it off with Todd Pratt, and then to make that comeback against the Braves, being down 3-0 and forcing a Game 6 and almost forcing a Game 7, I really think those Mets teams deserve more appreciation than they tend to get.
I agree. Notable. Very, very notable. And in the mix, Chris, we have guys like Daryl Strawberry, Dwight Gooden, David Cone, and, of course, Joe Torre. And you had some polarizing figures there.
Yeah, it's just sort of weird how things work out in life where you have so many ex-Mets who come to the Yankees and not only come to the Yankees but succeed or sort of get their second chances and rebuild their careers. Daryl Strawberry, Dwight Gooden among them. David Cone, right, comes to the Yankees, pitches a perfect game. Joe Torre comes to the Yankees, wins a championship that he never got as a Mets manager. I mean, even guys like Mel Stottlemyre, who was a former Mets pitching coach, and even Don Zimmer, a former Met, and Willie Randolph, who was a former Met.
Right.
It's just sort of weird, the list of Mets that just goes on for that late 90s, 2000 Yankees. And it does add some flavor to that, I guess you could call it a rivalry, that you have so many of these ex-Mets who are now winning in pinstripes. It made it a little bit more special.
It did. Now, would you say that this was a golden age of New York baseball, Chris?
I would. Everybody thinks that the age that they grew up watching baseball is the golden age of baseball, right? And I think that's true, but I think the first real true golden age of New York City baseball was the 1950s with the Yankees, Giants, and Dodgers.
Absolutely.
Right? Obviously,
yeah.
they leave after 57, so you don't really have that. And then the Mets and Yankees are never really good at the same time for a sustained period of time until you get to the late 90s. And then you add in interleague play, and I think what you get is just some incredibly exciting baseball for the two teams individually and then against each other. You have some really incredible moments in those early Subway Series matchups, not including the World Series, just in the regular season. So I think when you look at all of that together, you're definitely looking at least a second golden age of New York City baseball.
Agreed. Okay, we're speaking with Chris Donnelly tonight. The book is called Get Your Tokens Ready, about the road to the 2000 Subway Series. Mets-Yankees, of course. Now, let's talk about the Subway Series, Chris. Now, Game 1, I watched that, and it still sticks in my craw to this day. talk a little bit about Game 1.
Yeah, Game 1, well, first of all, going into the series, it was not, nobody really felt like this was going to be a pushover, really, for either team. I think the teams were fairly evenly matched. Yes, the Yankees were coming off of winning three or four championships, but they had struggled late in 2000, and they'd almost been eliminated by the A's in the division series, and the Mets really hadn't been challenged too hard in their march to the World Series. But you get to Game 1, and just a lot of things don't go right for the Mets, and much of it is self-inflicted. They make a few base-running gaffes. They run into some really bad luck with the direction of some balls, and, of course, the famous Timo Perez play where Todd Zeal hits one off of Andy Pettit. It hits off the top of the wall, falls down. Timo slows up because he thinks it's a home run, and he gets thrown out at the plate.
Yeah.
I will say this. In Perez's defense, almost everyone watching at the game and at home thought the ball went in the stands. Mm-hmm. The only people who really didn't were David Justice and Derek Jeter, who ended up doing the relay throw to get Perez. All that said, I understand you run hard until somebody tells you not to run. And it still just sort of exemplifies everything that went wrong in game one. And then, of course, Benitez gives up the lead in the ninth inning, and then the Yankees win it in the bottom of the 12th.
It was quite Metsian, as I say, Chris. That's the term I use, very Metsian. Now, would you agree with the statement that Steinbrenner's worst nightmare would be losing that series to the Mets?
I think it would be Steinbrenner's worst nightmare, and I think it would have been the Yankee player's worst nightmare, because it would have been George's worst nightmare.
Yeah.
If you speak to a lot of players, they'll tell you it didn't matter that we'd won three of the last four. Had we lost that one, those championships wouldn't have meant a thing, because that's all we would have heard about for the rest of our lives. And I think they're right, and George's behavior shows that during the series. George wasn't in the visiting clubhouse for the 98 and 99 World Series, right? He wasn't sort of a presence during those World Series. He was everywhere during the 2000 World Series. He's in the Shea Stadium visitors locker room. He's hanging out. He's pacing. He's frantic. He thinks that the locker room is trash, so he has all the Yankees furniture brought from Yankee Stadium to Shea Stadium before Game 4. He's paranoid. He thinks that the Mets are bugging the clubhouse. David Cohn has fun with this, and it's before Game 5, and Fox is setting up the wires and the cables and everything in case celebration, and Cohn points to the wires and says, "Look, boss, there it is, there's the bug." And a pipe actually bursts during Game 4 and floods the Yankees clubhouse, and I think George, to his dying day, always thought that the Mets did that on purpose to mess with the Yankees.
That is amazing. Yeah, only George would come up with something like that. Now, we have another piece of drama that plays out in the series, and it was the Piazza Clemens controversy. And to this day, people despise Roger Clemens because of that. People think that Piazza should have reacted differently. Give us your take on that situation, Chris.
Well, I'll start by saying I fully understand the emotions on both sides in this incident, and I'll give you my take, but I also just want to point out the absurdity of everything that happened to lead to that moment. So I think that when you look at it in slow motion, and right after it happened, and with the commentary from Tim McCarver on TV and some of the reporters, it's very easy to understand, especially with the emotion of Clemens having hit Piazza in the head earlier that season, why a lot of people think Clemens threw the bat at Piazza on purpose. I have no hesitation in saying that that is not what happened. I do think in the initial moment when the bat was coming towards him that Clemens did actually think it was the ball. Obviously, once he feels it, he knows it's not the ball. So that excuse doesn't mean anything after that fact. And then he immediately flips it away. If you watch it in real time, it's very clear that he doesn't know where Piazza is and he doesn't throw it at him. He just gets rid of it. Still, it's very irresponsible on Clemens' part. He had what was essentially a weapon that he just flings off the field, and he should have known better. But what really fascinates me about that whole incident is how many things had to happen for it to actually happen.
Yeah.
It had to be Piazza versus Clemens. It could have been any other hitter. It could have been any other pitcher. It had to be those two. It had to be Piazza breaking his bat in the way that it broke, whereas bats normally break into little shards or pieces. This one just completely breaks in two. The bat has to skid along the grass and hop up to Clemens the exact way in which it did. Piazza has to not know where the foul ball is so that he starts running out of the box because he doesn't see that it goes into the stands. And he has to be right where he is for Clemens to throw the bat directly into his path, almost a foot or two away from him. It's crazy that all of those things actually happen, because if even one of them doesn't play out that way, you and I are not having this conversation.
Right. It's just, it's baseball. It's the poetic justice and the game. That's what happens. That's what makes baseball baseball.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's these little moments, and you look at the whole series, and the whole series is little moments. And unfortunately for the Mets, most of them did not go their way. But you think, man, no ball, the way Tadzio hits it, hits the top of the wall and falls down. It always goes into the stands for a home run. That ball falls down, Timo gets thrown out, right?
Yeah.
The Clemens Piazza incident with the way the bat went. And even just through the rest of the series, these small little moments. I mean, David Cone comes into relief in game four. He had a terrible regular season, and he faces Mike Piazza, the best hitting catcher of all time. And he somehow, with basically nothing left in the tank, figures out a way to retire him and help preserve the lead for the Yankees. It's just these little moments that can change the course of history. And like you said, it's what makes baseball so incredible.
Right. Now, the Mets could have easily won every game.
Correct. Absolutely. The tying or winning run was at the plate at the end of every single game in that series. And if just some of these things had slipped, the Mets could have won that series in six or seven games, or the Yankees would have won it in seven games. It just would have been extended. But I think in years from now, when people don't necessarily remember, they might look back and go, that was a five-game series. That couldn't have been too close or exciting. Every game was exciting. It was incredibly close. And just one or two things could have changed the whole outcome of the series.
Right. The dynamic could have gone the other way very, very easily. Now,
yeah.
Louis Soho turns out to be a name in this series, right?
It's another one of those wonderful things about baseball that you've got Mike Piazza and Derek Jeter, right, and Al Leiter and Mike Hampton and Andy Pettit. You've got all these well-known, established names, and the ultimate hero in that series turns out to be Louis Soho, because he hit a four-hop ground ball up the middle that, and Louis Soho had so little power that Jay Payton in center field was essentially playing a fifth infielder like they do in softball sometimes. That's how close to the infield he was. And Louis Soho is the hero on that base hit, and that wins the World Series. It's obviously, if you're a Mets fan, it is not a great memory, but it is just one of those amazing things about baseball that doesn't necessarily happen in other sports, where at any moment, somebody who you've never heard of before and may have never heard of afterward can be an eternal hero.
Now, the book is titled, folks, Get Your Tokens Ready, talks about the road to the Subway Series. Now, what would you consider, Chris, key moments on the road for each team?
Well, for the Yankees, it goes back a little further. It actually goes back to the second book in this trilogy, Road to Nowhere, when George gets banished from baseball and it's turned into a suspension. But that allowed the Yankees to really rebuild and to not trade away their top-tier prospects like an Andy Pettit or a Bernie Williams, all of which George Steinbrenner wanted to do but was thankfully stopped from doing, if you're a Yankees fan. So that really helped them. And then as they become champions and grow stronger, right, they become more the Yankees that people think of as the evil empire. Mm-hmm. And they do start, people would call it buying the best players. I wouldn't call it that, but that's the perception, right? They do get guys like Chuck Knoblauch and Roger Clemens to help keep the dynasty going. And for the Mets, he's a polarizing figure, I think, but Bobby Valentine being manager, it was just one of those things that at the moment was the right move, and he was the right guy for that team. He was the right mix of serious and kind of goofy and baseball smart and willing to try certain things. And also the Mets were having faith in their youth movement again. They weren't doing what the early 90s Mets teams were, which was trying to buy up all the free agents they could. They obviously made some true free agent signings in that time, but they just were smarter about who they were picking up and how they would fit in the clubhouse. And it all came together for both teams.
Now, just looking at the outfield of the New York Mets in that 2000 series, Chris, how Bobby Valentine got as much as he did out of those three guys. And, you mentioned those three guys on a World Series team. It's not real impressive.
It is. It's Jay Payton, Timo Perez, Benny Agbayani. You got to give credit for them getting as far as they did. Those guys had great seasons, great moments to get them there. Ultimately, their careers didn't pan out, I think, as people had hoped. And the question has been put to me, is that the weakest outfield that any World Series team has ever put together? I honestly don't know if the answer is yes. But you do sort of look back and go, wow, that's kind of incredible that they got there. But it also, again, speaks to the beauty of baseball in that if people can put together the right moments and just string together the right amount of success in the right period of time, you can get to a championship. You can get to a World Series. And I mean, I would argue that the 99 Mets were a much better team than the 2000 Mets, but the 2000 Mets just figured out the right way to make it work and to get to the World Series.
Look at the 69 Mets, Chris. I just had Art Shamsky on the show previous to you, and there's a perfect example about putting things together, right place, right time, and everything just strings together.
Yeah, it's just a moment, and it's just one of those funny things, not just about baseball, but about sports, where you could bring the same group of people back a few months later, and for whatever reason, it doesn't work again, and it's not like it was just a couple of months earlier. And that was kind of the case with the 2000 Mets. In 2001, they high expectations, they didn't live up to them, and the franchise started to fall apart after that, and kind of bottoms out in 2003, and then they begin another rebuilding process and get back to the postseason in 2006. But it is just one of those strange things where it all clicked in 2000, despite some injuries, despite some performances that they hoped would be better from some players and didn't get. And it's a moment in time, and it's a wonderful thing about sports is that those moments in times can happen to any person in any team.
And you talk about Bobby Valentine. We mentioned him earlier. There's a guy with probably a distinguished managing career. I mean, he didn't win the big ones, but he lasted a long time with a few teams. And it's unfortunate that the thing he's remembered for is the fake mustache.
Right. It's the fake mustache is it's funny because it's a funny moment, and it's lightheartedness, and it shows his sense of humor and that he was willing to do something just kind of dumb. Because why not? You know, ultimately, what does it matter? And it's something that you would never, ever in a million years see somebody on the Yankees do. And I think that's one of the things that Mets fans like about the organization and about being a Mets fan is that they are willing to do some crazy and quirky things like that. And that they're not the perceived stiffiness or stuffiness of the New York Yankees. Valentine's an interesting person. Interviewed him for the book. And speaking to him, I mean, I understand why people have strong views about him, because in that time, you can see everything that people feel about him. You can see the baseball genius at work. You can see some of the standoffishness. You can see the humor. It's all there. And a great baseball mind, ultimately it doesn't pan out in New York. Ultimately it didn't pan out in Boston. But I don't think anybody would argue that Bobby Valentine doesn't know about baseball. And to hear him talk about it, it was a great experience just to hear him describe certain games and just the things that, as a fan watching a game, you might not consider or might not even realize are going on.
Yeah, great story. Great story, Chris. Well, you're going to be up in Cooperstown, so I am going to try to stop by to see you. Tell the folks who are going to be up there about the signing up in Cooperstown.
Absolutely. I'll be up there for Hall of Fame induction weekend coming up this weekend. I'll be in front of Willis Money Books from 4 to 6 on Friday and then from 10 to 12 on Saturday. Please stop on by. I'll be happy to chat.
Willis Money Books, folks, is on Main Street in Cooperstown. It's just by the store, I think it's 7th Inning Stretch, with the big marquee, the former theater out there. And Chris will be out there. Get a nice signed copy of Have Your Tokens Ready. And it's a great story. The road to the 2000 Subway Series. The moral of the story, right in the book, folks. You'll have to read it to find out. Well, Chris, it's been a pleasure. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us here at Sports Talk New York. Again, folks, get your tokens ready. The late 1990s road to the Subway Series. Thank you again, Chris.
Bill, thanks so much. I'll see you in a couple days.
Gotcha. That's Chris Donnelly, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we will speak with Steve Ditmore about his new book on the forgotten Dodger. Who is that? You got to stick around and find out.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.